Good morning, everyone. Welcome to CSIS. My name is Peter DeShazo. I'm the director of the Americas program at CSIS. It's a pleasure to open what I'm sure will be a very interesting discussion of the Venezuela-Russian relationship, one that has gotten a considerable amount of attention in past years for a number of different reasons. Russian interest in Venezuelan energy, arms purchases by President Chavez in Venezuela from Russia, presence of Russian battleship or a cruiser in the region for the first time in perhaps many years, and a generally close relationship between two countries that traditionally had not been all that close in the region. So it's an interesting opportunity to examine that relationship. And we have with us today three eminent scholars on Russian and on Venezuelan foreign policy. The first speaker will be Dr. Stephen Blank, who has served as the Strategic Studies Institute's expert on the Soviet bloc and the post-Soviet world since 1989. Dr. Blank holds a PhD in history from the University of Chicago and right now is doing research on proliferation, the revolution in military affairs, and energy and security in Eurasia. He'll be followed by Dr. Carlos Romero, a distinguished Venezuelan scholar, expert on Venezuelan foreign affairs. He is a professor with tenure at the Institute of Political Science in the Department of Judicial and Political Science at the Universidad Central de Venezuela in Caracas. He has a graduate of the University of Pittsburgh with an MA and a PhD in political science from the Universidad Central. Again, one of Venezuela's most distinguished scholars. We're delighted to have Dr. Romero here with us today. Our third speaker is Dr. Andrew Cutchins, senior fellow and director of the CSIS Russia and Eurasia program, expert in domestic and foreign policies of Russia. From 2000 to 2006, Dr. Cutchins was senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he was director of its Russia and Eurasia program in Washington, D.C. He has an MA and PhD from Johns Hopkins SAIS. So we'll begin with Dr. Blank, and again, I would like to welcome you all.
Thank you, Peter. I'd like to thank Peter and Andrew for inviting me. My remarks do not reflect the opinion of the Army, the Defense Department, or the U.S. government, or anybody else. They're just mine. And I would like to talk about Russian policy towards Venezuela in context of Russia's overall policy towards Latin America, because I think it's necessary to set that stage so that we understand what Russia's broader goals are in terms of the Latin American region as a whole, and then focus on the specifics. And Russian policy, therefore, is a subset not towards Venezuela, is not just a subset of its overall foreign policy, but of its Latin American policy. And that Latin American policy did not begin last year. When the Russian Navy showed up for exercises, it was not the case, as a lot of the media put it, that the Russians had suddenly, like Columbus, discovered South America. But rather, Russia, beginning in 1997, began to pay attention to Latin America as a diplomatic and then trade partner. And the motives for this attention that Russia paid to Latin America, in Cuba and the rest of the countries there, as well as Venezuela, had to do with rather traditional motives. And it begins with Primakov's tour as foreign minister in 97. Again, in 2003, Igor Ivanov, who was Primakov's successor, and now Lavrov's predecessor, went there. Putin went there for a meeting of the APEC in Chile, I believe it was 2004 or 2005. And these visits, plus subsequent visits by Lavrov and last year by Medvedev, indicate a rising Russian interest in Latin America as a whole, not just Venezuela. The motives are very classical. Trade, increased trade with Latin America, arms sales, which are very important to the Russian defense industry because it is seeking to diversify its client base. It does not want to be tied any longer to China and India alone, or to China alone in particular. There was a point in time when it was selling 40% a year of its exports to China. They don't want to be doing that anymore. They claim they're going down to about 10% a year, and they're trying to make that difference up with sales in Latin America, among other places. Furthermore, in the diplomatic arena, the idea behind Primakov's visit is to reassert that Russia is a great global power. Now, this obsession, and there's no other word to characterize it, of Russian foreign policy with status is something that all of us have to deal with. It was even true in 97 when the country was basically prostrate that they were claiming that they ought to be equal to everybody in world politics. And Primakov publicly said, I'm coming to Latin America to show that we are this great player with global interests and accounts and that we can't be neglected. More recently, as Russo-American relations have steadily declined, and not just under Putin, there was already decline under Yeltsin and Primakov, Russia is attempting to increase its political influence, to solicit Latin American support on various issues for Russia's concept of a multipolar world. Now, the idea of a multipolar world in Moscow may not be the same as it is in American academia. I'm sure it's not, as a matter of fact. The multipolar world, as far as Moscow is concerned, is that there are a number of poles, U.S., Europe, Russia, and China, and that they ought to steer the destiny of the world, so to speak, and that, therefore, Russia ought to be in the big leagues and play at all tables. It is attempting to be a member of all important organizations. If you remember the famous line by Groucho Marx that he wouldn't want to be a member of any club that would have him, Russia wants to be a member of even those clubs that wouldn't have it. And we see that in Latin America, where it's attempting to join various security organizations, although how Russia can contribute to Latin American security escapes me. Maybe somebody else knows how. But it's clearly a policy that is intentionally and fundamentally anti-American. There is really no sign in Russian writing of any and policy of any interest in or concern for the overall security of Latin America. It's not on their agenda. What they want is simply to be part of the action, and they are therefore using Venezuela in that context and relating to it in that context. It is an anti-American policy, finally. At bottom, it is an anti-American policy that aims to instrumentalize the region as a series of countries or even as a weak but discernible political bloc to support Russian positions against U.S. dominance in world affairs. Therefore, Latin American states that wish to challenge America need to rely on Moscow, Nicaragua, Venezuela, Cuba, and so on. More recently, with the realization in Moscow or the argument in Moscow that the BRIC stands for some sort of potentially discrete bloc that has something to say in world politics, that we're going to see an attempt, beginning with the meetings in Yekaterinburg last month, but further on, to win over Brazil. And Brazil really is the key player in economic and political terms in Latin America by any index except maybe military. Now, in that context, they are not giving up their relationship with Venezuela. But there's some very interesting things that come out. We saw in March, for example, that Chavez indicated that he might be willing to have a Russian air base in Venezuela, and that the Russian Air Force said, we would be happy to have an air base in La Orquila, an island off the coast of Venezuela, if the political decision makers accept it, indicating that the Russian Air Force wanted this. The Russian Navy would like to have a base in the Caribbean also. And there are elements in Russia, particularly those around Putin, and as Andy and I were just talking, Mr. Putin is an inveterately anti-American policymaker. Last summer, he sent his right-hand man, Igor Sechin, to Latin America. And Sechin, when he was there, made clear not just that Russia was an anti-American power that would support these governments, but he also was talking to Cuba and Venezuela and Nicaragua about forming an anti-American alliance. And that's a big step forward. Now, nothing has come of that since Sechin went over. Medvedev did not mention anything about that in his trip or never talked about it publicly, but it indicates at least to those of us who follow Russia that, as many of you may know, there appears to be some sort of divergence or split even between Putin and Medvedev, or at least their respective entourages. And one of the elements in that is the idea of a tougher line against the United States rather than a line that emphasizes economic reform at home. Putin stands for the former, Sechin certainly does. And this idea of pushing the envelope, of sending the Russian fleet to exercise in the Caribbean to show the Americans that they can't just go into the Black Sea, although we're still there, with impunity, and that we can Russia can interfere in America's backyard, or that we can build an air base in Latin America, clearly has something to do with the Putin line in foreign policy as opposed to Medvedev. Venezuela is also vital to Russia, not vital to Russia, but is of the importance because of the scale of arms sales that have taken place in the last 6 years. And again, the arms sales to Latin America did not begin last year. They began in 2003 when Ivanov made his tour around the continent. Venezuela has bought $5.4 billion worth of Russian arms since 2003, when the Russians began to realize that Chavez was a serious anti-American actor who they could work with in furthering their own anti-American agenda, and he perceived the same thing vis-a-vis Moscow. Venezuela, as far as Moscow is concerned, is the most outstanding example of the overtly anti-American thrust in Latin America. That thrust comprises both domestic politics with the election of leftist governments, for example, in Bolivia and in Ecuador, and previously in Honduras, where Zelaya was clearly trying to wage his own Bolivarian revolution, we might say, in one country before the military unceremoniously threw him out last week. And therefore, the Russians are supporting him and also attempting to work with Chavez, not just on strategic issues, but on economic issues, trying to set up, for example, most recently, a bank, which will be a joint Russo-Venezuelan bank, which is part of Russia's campaign against the dollar, and also work with Chavez on some of the projects to develop energy in Latin America in general and in Venezuela in particular. Now, there's no doubt in my mind that Moscow fully is aware of his support for leftist populist regimes throughout the continent and his support for the FARC and the fact that Venezuela has now become a major route for the transshipment of narcotics to the United States and Africa and Europe, and that Russia is involved in this. The arms that Russia is selling him are particularly dangerous in this context. Indeed, those arms are perhaps the most dangerous manifestation of the Russian thrust in Latin America. And I'm not talking about the Sukhoi 30s. What we are talking about in this connection is the factory that is going to build bullets for the 100,000 AK-47s that Moscow is selling to Venezuela, which can only be used by the FARC. Nobody else uses that kind of caliber of ammunition. The Raul Reyes tapes and computer evidence that came out last year showing his support for the FARC indicates that he is actively involved in trying to destabilize Colombia and with it U.S. policy in Latin America. Nikolai Patrushev, the Russian Security Council secretary, went to Ecuador last year and talked about coordinating Venezuelan and Ecuadorian pressure against Colombia. It's very clear that this was Moscow's objective. It didn't get a lot of press, but it was reported in the Russian media. And it's very clear, therefore, that Moscow is using the arms sales and its energy sales to Chavez to support him, to support his vision of a Bolivarian revolution and of an anti-American crusade. The arms that have been sold to Venezuela in this context, therefore, make no strategic sense unless Chavez is actually playing an arms race in Latin America, and a number of Latin American governments, like Brazil, have asked themselves and Chavez why it is that Chavez feels impelled to buy these weapons, and they've gone back into buying weapons as well, and Russia would be only too happy to sell them weapons too. This is part of the Russian game. We'll sell to everybody, just make money and make trouble for the United States. Since there is no U.S. military threat right now to Chavez or anybody else, the argument that we need Su-30s to defend the oil derricks doesn't make a lot of sense in any kind of strategic term. The systems that Moscow has sold to Chavez, therefore, include 24 Sukhoi 30 fighters, the 100,000 Kalashnikov AK-47s, AK-103 assault rifles, BMP-3 infantry fighting vehicles, T-72 main battle tanks, which are supposed to be bought later this year, 53 MiG-35 helicopters, that is the MiG-17 V-S and 35M, and ammunition factories for the rifles. And Venezuela was planning, at least before the crisis struck, to buy IL-76 and Ilyushin 78 tankers and cargo aircraft and a fifth-generation anti-aircraft system for no good reason, and Igla-S portable surface-to-air missiles. And Venezuela also was seeking Hunter attack helicopters, the MiG-28N, and is discussing the purchase of submarines. Now, the submarines could be used, there's no other purpose that makes any sense in the Venezuelan context, either as a transshipment vehicle for drugs out of Venezuela so they can elude coast guards and surface vessels in the high seas, or as perhaps installations for a potential temporary base for the Russian Navy in Latin America, Venezuela in particular. Again, this seems to be an idea that Putin and his team would like to follow up if they could. Right now, they're unable to do so. On the economic front, there was a lot of talk about grandiose projects, trans-Amazonian pipeline and so on. Those have been shelved. The Russian energy companies and the Russian government have no money for investment in Latin America at present in these projects. So all the talk that we hear coming out of Moscow, which is a standard Russian policy of promising the moon and delivering a star, is going to be replicated in Latin America because simply Russia does not have the resources. Nonetheless, the discussions about these huge infrastructural projects is continuing. If you do want to follow the money in Latin America, it's coming from China, not from Moscow. And while there will be economic assistance to Venezuela and, for that matter, to Cuba, it's going to be on a very limited basis, and it'll be highly conditional in return for essentially being export subsidies to buy Russian goods. So the conclusion I would draw about this is that Russian policy towards Latin America is part of its overall foreign policy, which I believe is fundamentally anti-American in content as well as style, and in Latin America aims to support Chavez primarily because of his anti-American orientation and is conniving with Chavez to help undermine pro-American regimes like Colombia. In this context, the arms sales being the most dangerous aspect of this. Nonetheless, if the energy prices turn up, as Moscow is confident they will, and they are at least saying they are, and as Chavez certainly hopes they will, then we will see more money and more interest by Russia in Latin America. Medvedev stated that his trip was only the beginning. And it is only the beginning if the Russian economy and, for that matter, Venezuelan economies can recover from this crisis. Therefore, the real determinant as to the extent of which Russia and Venezuela will be able to forge a truly meaningful strategic partnership will be the progress of their economic recovery in the context of the global recovery. But if that does come about, we will have more reason to have conferences like this in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Romero.
Thank you to the Center for Strategic International Studies and to Peter DeShazo for the opportunity to share with you my views about the relation within Venezuela and Russia.
The mic's not on.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. It is a commonplace to say that a revolutionary government plays politics with both hands. On the one hand, it practices the rules of diplomacy, and on the other hand, it promotes its own ideals and goals, trying to break the international status quo and playing geopolitics as a zero-sum game. Venezuela is a classic case of a revolutionary government that, since 1999, has expanded an anti-American foreign policy. Secondly, Caracas has built up a set of alliances with governments that are defined as rivals of the United States along the idea of the creation of a multipolar world. Hugo Chavez has established an special relationship has promoted a political alliance, economic and military, with ALBA members, has established parallel relations with related parties and social left movements in Latin America, and has sought to expand its relations with countries with a global role, such as China, India, Iran, and Russia. Russia is part of this broad design. Relations with Venezuela and Russia start in 1945 when Caracas established diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union. These relations were broken in 1952, and since then, until 1969, nothing important happened except for Caracas' worries of the Soviet government, Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and Soviet mass organization supporting the soldiers of Latin America and the Caribbean radicals, and Venezuela allegations of a Cuba-Soviet support of Venezuelan Communist Party. In 1969, diplomatic relations were resumed between Moscow and Caracas as a part of the war detente, and therefore, for more than 30 years, political relations between the two countries were maintained in a warm and moderate climate and with a small scale of trade, something different from the Argentinian case, for example, in the trade area, or ideological case of Cuba. Trade in Venezuelan-Russian relations did not spend more than $200 million a year and never mean up to the 2% of total Soviet foreign trade with Latin America, only derived from an oil agreement, triangulation, with Cuba, signed in 1975, in which Venezuela sent 20,000 oil barrels per day to Cuba, and the Soviet Union sent the same amount to Venezuelan-owned refineries in Europe. At that time, trade was mainly concentrated in the agreement to provide those barrels to Cuba, and Venezuela purchased minimum quantities of products such as Soviet and then Russian caviar, vodka, publications, print materials, and fish. The Soviet Union bought pipes, oil products, iron, and aluminum, although in small quantities. The internal change in the USSR, known as a perestroika, and the new Soviet foreign policy, known as the new thinking, did not alter trade between Venezuela with the USSR and the oil exchange with Cuba. By the year 1999, the condition of this exchange and in general state-state relations were minimal. From the first decade of the 21st century, Russia resumed its interest in the international arena and seeks market opportunities in Latin America, a region where she can also expand their power within an offer of energy and military products, raw materials, especially food, its possible participation in projects of oil and gas fields. Now, Russia is returning to Latin America after the Russian, like so-called, the lost decade of the 90s. In 2008, Russian has trade with the region of more than $15 billion of American dollars, $6 billion with Brazil, 40% of the total, $1 billion with Venezuela, almost military goods, which is incredible if you compare with Venezuela trade relation with the United States. And Russia has $400 million with Cuba. In those general paramount, which role the Russian card plays in Venezuelan war strategy? Venezuela has encroached on lands that are often very troubling for the U.S. Threats of a Venezuelan oil embargo, the refusal of Venezuela to promote military cooperation and to participate in regional and bilateral military exercises with the United States, the proto-military alliance outside the region, which aims Venezuela the purchase of Russian and Chinese weapons, the bonds of collaboration with terrorists and regimes with nuclear capabilities, the shelter to suspect drug traffickers, anti-Israel and anti-Semitic actions, and expropriation of private enterprises, local and foreign, has to be borne by the United States. In this way, Venezuela do not certainly represent a military threat to the government of President Obama although I will say that Venezuela will be a test case for the Obama administration as to prove the validity of the new White House style of diplomatic style of smart power to develop the U.S. national interest. Washington and Caracas hold a debate on how to define and cope with the international and hemispheric agendas. Of course, both countries are looking to each other with suspicious minds. The United States doesn't like the iteration of the Bolivarian Revolution and aims to reduce dependence of oil in Venezuelan oil import from a country that is considered hostile to its interests. Venezuela seeks to distance from the United States, and President Chavez has assumed that Washington wants to overthrow him. The threat, in my opinion, is political. Russia wants to play with Venezuela in the international scenario, and Venezuela sees Russia as the enemy of the United States. And believe me, with some kind of sorrows about the old Soviet Union. In spite of the fact that the government of Venezuela don't realize that the current leader of Moscow has privatized the economy, believe in capitalism, and say adios to Marxism long time ago. As Strobe Talbot recently said, Hobbes won, Marx lost. The possibility of a strategic alliance and an extra-regional military ties between Venezuela, Cuba, and Iran, and Venezuela, Cuba, and Russia give the possibility of a restoration of a military alliance between Russia and Cuba and the reinstatement of the Russian military presence in Cuba. According to Chavez, Russia and Venezuela, quotation, should be strategic allies in oil and in the technical military cooperation, and that the Russian arms guarantee the sovereignty of Venezuela, which is threatened by the United States. One cannot fail to mention the fact that Venezuelan support Russia during the conflict with Georgia last year. In a statement from the Venezuelan foreign minister, it was said that the government of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, quotation, note that the Russian Federation under international agreement legitimizing the presence of the peacemaker in South Ossetia, acting to preserve the life of the population as well as the fellow countrymen. Since 1999, President Chavez has been in Russia for six times, and more than 45 instruments of cooperation between Russia and Venezuela has been signed. In addition to the arms purchase agreements, an agreement of cooperation for peaceful use of nuclear energy, one bilateral agreement for work in the rich golden mine Las Cristinas, funding the foundation of the Russian Venezuela Entrepreneur Council, a binational fund, the creation of a national fund of $12,000 million that now becomes a binational bank, the creation of a direct air route to link the two capitals, and the creation of a consortium between Gazprom, Neft, other Russian oil companies, which are administered by the high-level intergovernmental commission, Venezuela and Russia. There have been five CIAM meetings, and CIAM is organizing an oil gas production project and designing of a memorandum for the evaluation and certification of reserve in the Ayacucho Block Number 2 in the Orinoco Belt. This memorandum confirms the joint venture of some oil Soviet companies in the area of the Orinoco Belt. The Russian company Lukoil also signed an agreement with PDVSA for joint exploration of the Junin Block Number 3, also in the Orinoco Belt. It is also on the map a possible process of Russian oil in Venezuela. U.S.-based refineries owned by Citgo will refuse to do that. Furthermore, the gas oil company Gazprom signed an agreement with PDVSA to explore oil deposits in Ayacucho No. 3 block and Carabobo No. 1 block, also in the Orinoco Belt. Venezuela is buying also weapons and military equipment through 12 contracts signed since 2005 by over $5,000 million, which the way of a direct payment from Venezuela and through a recent credit extended by Russia of on an amount of $1,000 million. In the year 2007, Venezuela became the third largest buyer of Russian weapons globally, after China and India. If we calculate the rate of Russian arms imports per capita, Venezuela in 2007 spent $33 per capita in Russian arms. China spent $0.96 and India $0.79. Venezuela, furthermore, moved from the 39th leading arms importer in the world in 1999 to the post of the number 9. Dr. Blank already mentioned the classification of the arms purchased by Venezuela, but I would like to point out that there's going to be a discussion about the possibility of a new kind of purchase by Venezuelan of a second generation of sophisticated arms, such as the specified number of Sukhoi Su-35 aircraft, the Strela S-300 anti-aircraft system, T-72M tanks, three submarines, Project 636, and one submarine Project 877, 12 heavy military transport carriers Ilyushin 76, and 400 BMP No. 3 armored vehicles. In the meantime, President Chavez announced that he developed a naval exercise in areas of Venezuela with Russia, which were held from the 19th of November 2008. Russia moved without nuclear weapons on board known as a Blackjack and the Tu-95 MC bombers, cruise nuclear propulsion Peter the Great, the frigate Admiral Shabanenko, and support submarine hunters vessels. The Bolivarian government intends to discuss the possibility of the cooperation of Cuba to join those military maneuvers between Russia and Venezuela. And the idea was to be repeated in the occasion of the visit to Caracas of the Russian Vice Premier Igor Sechin in September 2008 after visiting Cuba, but it was certainly refused by Moscow. It was that highlighted in the recent visit by President of the Republic of Venezuela to Moscow in June of this year that result in the creation of the binational bank with a founding capital of $4,000 million and the participation of Russia in a 50% share, something similar to the binational banks opened by Venezuela with Iran and China. And an important credits transaction also with Japan, Brazil, and Qatar. Projects were also signed in the geological exploration of oil and gas in Venezuela by the Soviet companies, a draft nuclear cooperation with peaceful purposes to refund a credit of another $1,000 million for military purchases, specifically to finance the new wave or the new generation of arms in order to be sold by Venezuela. But are we in the middle of an important military alliance between Venezuela and Russia? I don't think so. These maneuvers and these sales, it doesn't mean a major challenge to U.S. military capabilities in Latin America and the Caribbean. And we don't have to be fear for that. So please, don't be panic. Venezuela doesn't have ballistic missiles, nuclear weapons of mass destruction, and destructive arsenals. As the former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice used to say, alleged Russian advance in the region was anachronic. But symbolically speaking, the military exercise and the bilateral military cooperation draw a huge attention and brought again to the region the debate on the global military competition between Russia and the United States. The deepening of a security policy different will reduce the possibility of a common hemispheric strategy and put in the field again the discussion on the consideration of Latin America as a zone of peace, as a zone of influence by the United States, or as an area in dispute in geopolitical competition between those world powers. From a regional point of view, the scenario of a deepening of relations between Venezuela and Russia will lead to a disagreement on continental security measures and instruments among Latin American leaders, think, for example, in the Colombia of Uribe, and on definition of the alliance and the concept of the external enemy. Skip in three scenarios to view the future of the relation between Venezuela and the United States and Russia. First, the conditions to rebuild the relationship between the United States and Russia, based on mechanisms of mutual trust, will lead to the reruption of the Russian influence in Venezuela. The U.S. will not take care of the military sale, which are far away from the new concept of hybrid warfare. That's going to be the first scenario. The second scenario will be to deepen the difference and a final break between Venezuela and the United States, defined as a key to deepening the relationship with Russia and Venezuela. The U.S. government will be in alert. And a third scenario will be that the situation falls within a conflictive arena, but that does not necessarily create a rift between the two countries. Here, Moscow will continue to maintain a military and energy relation with Caracas, but not in an ideological base. The U.S. government will balance its behavior between toleration and pressure. In my opinion, the relation between Caracas and Moscow is not a new case. Third world governments and leaders already love to play the Russian card in the framework of the relation with Washington. On several occasions, the Soviet Union varied as well as Russia now in doing giving priority to the relations with the United States, expanding its diplomatic relations with governments of different ideological sides, or supporting friendly revolutionary governments even at the expense of reducing the impact of its global presence. To conclude, what is certain is that the revolutionary leader can abuse of the implementation of a warm approach to Moscow, playing the Russian card. The risk of pleasing the revolutionary leaders in his quest to achieve a different world without constraints is very big. The Soviet experiment that with Cuba and with other radical leaders of the third world. I wonder if I would the Russians repeat that path with Hugo Chavez. I don't have the answer. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Romero. Dr. Cutchins?
Thanks, Peter, very much for the opportunity to address this interesting relationship been developing over the years. And I have less to say in light of the two excellent presentations by my preceding colleagues. I suppose from the outset, in thinking about this relationship, I probably come to it a little bit more skeptical than the two previous speakers, Steve and Carlos. If I were to describe this in Shakespearean terms, I might say this is much ado about not very much, this relationship. If I were to put it in Russian terms, I would characterize this partnership as sort of a Potemkin partnership, not particularly filled with a lot of substance. I thought it was particularly striking, the trade numbers that Professor Romero put up there, $64 billion trade relationship that Venezuela has with the United States and a $1 billion relationship that it has with the Russian Federation. In thinking about the question, to what extent is Russia back in Latin America? Well, here I'll date myself because it takes me back to the title of a 1960s song by the group The Moody Blues entitled A Whiter Shade of Pale. This is kind of a whiter shade of pale version of Cold War, I think, that we'll see going on in Latin America. But I do have a couple of significant caveats to the broader skepticism I bring in looking at the developments of this relationship that I'll come to in my conclusions. It looks as though the Russians have found in Hugo Chavez an even more unpredictable and unreliable partner than themselves. And I think to some extent even Moscow is somewhat embarrassed to be embracing this guy too closely. There are aspects of the military exercises and the Medvedev visit last fall that struck me as actually somewhat comic. First of all, there was the incident where the bodyguards of Mr. Chavez and Mr. Medvedev came to blows as the Venezuelan leader was trying to board the Russian ship. Doesn't speak to a great trust in this alliance. Then there was also the story of Mr. Chavez's desire to award Dmitry Medvedev with the Medal of Simon Bolivar, which the Russians were not very anxious about receiving because, again, they didn't want to be viewed as part of this Bolivarian revolution that Mr. Chavez is cooking up in his head, and to some extent in reality as well. But the have to hand it to the to Mr. Chavez. They tricked Medvedev and basically gave him the medal on the spot, with the sense that it would be really bad form for Mr. Medvedev to refuse this while the cameras were running, and he. There is the photo op out there of Mr. Medvedev receiving the Medal of Simon Bolivar. The military exercises. Well, these were supposed to be three-day naval exercises. They were concluded after one day. It reminds me of Stalin's first five-year plan, which was completed in 3 years. I suppose they ran out of things to do. There really wasn't very much for them to do. There was, I think they each boarded the other's ships to make pretend inspections. I think there was some search and rescue training going on. But one of the more ironic or amusing aspects about this was the ships, the two key ships, Piotr Veliki, Peter the Great, and Admiral Chabanenka, are ships which are completely ill-designed for the types of naval exercises which the Venezuelans and the Russians managed to undertake. And it's my understanding that the only reasons those two ships were engaged in these exercises is they were likely the only two Russian ships that could make it all the way to Venezuela. Now, they were accompanied by two other ships with some Russian troops on them. I remember meeting with a colleague in the State Department around this time, and his comment was essentially, you know, and this was the pretty much the position of the U.S. government, was really playing this down, especially the Pentagon. But the more pointed comments were, you know, what we're really concerned about is, you know, the Russian Navy doesn't sail that much. And Piotr Veliki, Peter the Great, is a nuclear-powered ship. Our main hope is that it doesn't explode and cause a huge nuclear accident. But I think the larger question was, you know, when will be the second visit? And if there is a second visit, then that would be a sign that there actually is more to this than meets the eye. I think the relationship is principally is a byproduct of two factors, and both Steve and Carlos alluded to this. I think. And I would point to an article that came out 3 years ago by Mark Katz in the audience called The Putin-Chavez Relationship. Mark, this journal is really in search of a new name. It's still called Problems of Post-Communism. Anyway, it's a great piece, and I think he really outlines in a very prescient and analytically rock-solid manner the key factors behind the relationship, and I think they hold as true today as they did 3 years ago when Mark first wrote the piece. And the first factor, of course, is the oil price. Just to take further what Steve was saying, you know, the oil price is by far and away, I think, the most important driver, not only in Russia's foreign policy, but in its domestic politics, and also in its approach to the political economy and what it does with economic reform. And I've been arguing for the last several years that you can draw a very, very strong correlation between the revenues that Russia receives since 1973 in the first oil crisis from gas and oil exports with a aggressive or less aggressive foreign policy, a greater incentive or less incentive for economic reform, and greater centralization or less centralization of domestic politics in Russia. And it's essentially that formula is the behavior of typical of a petro-state, and I think that is probably broadly true of Mr. Chavez's Venezuela as well. When the oil price is very high, that affords the possibility for the Russians and the Venezuelans to reach economic deals, whether it be in the energy sector or in other sectors, which have less of a commercial basis because they have a lot more money lying around. with the Russians, I mean, again, there is a very, very powerful correlation between high revenues coming in from energy flows and assertive, aggressive, anti-American foreign policy that goes back 35 years. And there's just this is a kind of a coincidence, you know, that the two peaks of revenues, if you measure in current dollars, that Russia gets from its oil and gas exports occurred in the period of 1979-1980 and the summer of 2008, which also happened to correspond with the last two times that the Russians have used their military forces abroad, outside of their borders. Correlation, not causation, but it's strong, I think. The The second factor, I think, is for both of these countries, and again, this is just kind of repeating, I think, what my predecessors have said, is that this relationship, to a great extent, is derivative of their relationship with the United States. And obviously, for Russia, in the wake of the Georgia War last fall, where U.S.-Russian relations were, I think, not only at their post-Soviet nadir, I would take it back to somewhere in the 1980s, as to a point where U.S.-Russia relations had been so bad. The Russians were doing all kinds of things to demonstrate their dissatisfaction, particularly with the United States, and looking to poke our eye. I met with Vladimir Putin as part of the Valdai Discussion Club in September, and guess what? He was pretty angry with the United States, both for the Georgia War as well as the role that we had played in instigating the financial crisis, which was on the verge of overtaking Russia. Which gets me to the next point. Look, the economic crisis and the downturn in the oil price puts a huge constraint, if not kibosh, on how far this relationship can go. Look at this notion of the energy consortium that Mr. Sechin has so assiduously tried to develop in his several visits, actually, to Venezuela before Mr. Medvedev's. Well, as Steve pointed out precisely, he's exactly right. Right now, I mean, not only is there not funds available for investment in the Russian oil and gas sector, but there's hardly funds available to make non-commercially driven investments in Venezuela or other places as well. For the Venezuelans, why should they consider Russia a particularly reliable partner on energy issues, given the track record, the way Western companies have been treated? I think if the Russians were to treat the Venezuelans at some point, which I think is just not a matter of whether, but when, the way they have treated other energy majors, that's not going to go over very well with Mr. Chavez or whoever's in power in Venezuela. On the arms sales relationship, these are dangerous systems that the Russians are selling to the Venezuelans. But one thing I would point out as well, that for the Russians, they're really going down market. And it's not so much that the Russians have decided, well, we don't want to be so dependent upon the Chinese, I think. I would characterize it a little bit differently, in that the weakness of the Russian military-industrial complex is becoming increasingly evident, and their systems that they are ready to sell the Chinese are less attractive to the Chinese. I think that arms sales relationship is, reaching – the reason why those arms sales are going down fundamentally has to do, I think, with the Chinese driving the relationship. It's true the Russians have always been wary about sales to some extent of their most sophisticated weapon systems to the Chinese, but I think the fundamental fact is that there's been tremendous erosion, with the exception of a few arms systems, in the Russian military-industrial complex. So they go down market, and Venezuela they find an eager buyer. But here again, I would point out again in the different economic circumstances, this really puts greater constraints on how much Venezuela is in a position to buy with a lower oil price environment. I would say also the same about the plan, something similar about the plans for the development of the civilian nuclear reactors in Venezuela, which have also been talked about. Now, my caveat, the two caveats. One obvious caveat Steve made, if we are in a significantly higher oil price environment, then, we are going to be talking about this relationship more in the future, and we're going to see more of what we had seen up until 2008. The second caveat has to do with what for me has become a much darker interpretation of the Russian domestic political situation, and particularly the role of Vladimir Putin. And here I see, first of all, I don't think that Dmitry Medvedev has any significant decision-making authority over any significant issue in Russia today. And I think Mr. Putin has gone out of his way to make this eminently clear to Mr. Medvedev in sometimes very humiliating ways. I would point to the decision about the WTO made 2 days after Mr. Medvedev and other Russian government officials were in St. Petersburg, where I was, for the big economic forum, and there was no talk at all about this idea of a customs union. To me, that was Mr. Putin's way of saying, well, I can't say that, actually, in this public audience, but you know where I'm getting. Mr. Putin has evolved, I'm afraid, and I think it's in a rather toxic direction. He has, I think, developed a sense of impunity. He can do whatever he wants to whomever he wants, and he will not suffer. And I think there are lots of data points that we can point to over the last 8 or 9 years that lead him to this conclusion, whether it is the Yukos affair, whether it is gas crises with Ukraine, essentially getting away with war in Georgia, which I think may have been a straw that broke the camel's back. secondly, this is a guy that does carry grievances about the so-called humiliations of the West, and particularly the United States, that I recently wrote and compared to. He has a chip on his shoulder the size of the Rock of Gibraltar. That is also very worrisome, and I think it's gotten worse. The third point I think is that there's a tendency to overestimate their own strengths and to punch above their weight. Mr. Putin, I think this is even more so today. And I think you should look closely at the body language of the meeting of Mr. Putin with Barack Obama a few days ago in Moscow, and the approach that Mr. Putin took to that discussion, in which he initiated it with a 45 to 60 minute, well, some have described it as a the history of U.S.-Russian relations according to Vladimir, which I would describe as pretty much of a harangue. He is not in a mood to concede or to reset this relationship. And I think it would be naive on our part to – the problem with this whole argument about resetting the relationship is that it is based upon the assumption that there's been leadership change in Moscow and Washington. Well, that's true here, but in my view, it ain't true there. And I think that – I sense that Putin has gotten more uncomfortable with the nature of the relationship. Just as a final aside, again, this is not comic at all, but from an image standpoint, after Mr. Putin met with President Obama, he went to visit. First of all, he changed his clothes, took off his tie and his coat. He put on a black kind of – he was dressed all in black, dark sunglasses, basically his Darth Vladimir outfit. And he went to visit a motorcycle club gang called the Night Wolves, Nochni Volki, led by a gentleman who goes under the name of the Surgeon. I'm wondering how he got the name the Surgeon. He likes to cut up people.
Don't go there.
And these guys basically look like Hell's Angels. I grew up with in California back in the day or around. Kind of scary-looking guys who are about to embark on a trip to Sevastopol, the home of the Russian Crimea Fleet. The Russian Crimea Fleet. The Russian fleet.
Black Sea Fleet.
Black Sea Fleet, thank you. A Freudian slip there. Thousands of bikers going to Sevastopol. You have to look at these images, and to make that visit and have that meeting right after meeting with the U.S. president, an African-American U.S. president, sends a lot of warning signals to me. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Andy. Ladies and gentlemen, there's time for questions and answers. If you could please identify yourself by your name and your affiliation. The gentleman here in the center, please.
Thank you. Mark Katz, George Mason University.
Greg, we'll get you a microphone.
Sorry. Mark Katz, George Mason University. I want to thank you for three very fine presentations and thank Andy for his kind words about my article. My questions are for Professor Romero. I study Russian foreign policy. that, I think, has a certain logic. I have to admit, studying Hugo Chavez, it defies me. In other words, the Russians are bad. Hugo Chavez is really bad. And so I want to take advantage of you here to ask you two questions in particular. Andy referred to the nastiness of Russian petroleum firms and how they might deal with Venezuela. But, of course, Hugo Chavez has dealt pretty offhandedly with Western petroleum firms. When he needs money, he basically he doesn't mind redefining the terms on which they operate in. My question to you is, would he do this to Russian firms operating in Venezuela? Russian firms operating in Venezuela aren't doing so out of charity. They're there to make money. But Hugo Chavez seems to have a real visceral dislike for capitalism and seems to enjoy taking profits away from companies. Would he do this? Would he dare do this to the Russian firms operating in Venezuela? And my second question to you is, we heard about how, you know, during the conflict with Georgia last year, Venezuela expressed its support and understanding for the Russian position. My question is, why didn't Hugo Chavez recognize the independence of South Ossetia and Abkhazia? Nicaragua did, after all, and surely if Venezuela is such good friends with Russia, this would have been a logical step. And it would have cost Venezuela nothing. And so if you could enlighten me on this. I had expected that Venezuela would have done this before Nicaragua did, and yet Nicaragua did and Venezuela has not. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for the questions, Professor Katz. Well, the first answer has to be related with the new oil policy of Venezuela during the recent years, in which Venezuela tried to deal with state-owned companies. There is a broad understanding that capitalism is bad. So in order to develop the Orinoco Belt oil area and gas area, we have to, according to the Chavez government, deal with state-owned companies. In my opinion, President Chavez, having realized that the companies in Russia are or privatized or at least as share an amount of private capital, even not only private national capital but also international capital, as you can see in the participation of British Petroleum. So that's the first. I mean, understanding. We have to deal with state-owned companies. Secondly, we have to divert the oil business abroad the United States, and the Russian has the opportunity, and the Russian company has the opportunity to share that policy in order to develop the Orinoco Belt area. And thirdly, I will say that Chavez believe that it is more secure to have some kind of business relation with Russia in terms of the control of the Russian leader has on the Russian oil firms. And that's why he believe that there's going to be a good atmosphere to develop the relation between Russian companies and the government of Venezuela. But at the same time, I will say there is some kind of prestige in terms that Chavez could show to the international opinion that he's doing along well with the Russians in terms of the oil projects, and that the closeness of Venezuela and Russian relation is more than the military one. In relation with the second question, well, I have to tell you that I still think, I am thinking why Venezuela had that strong support of the Russian policy in the Georgia affair. And the only answer that I have on that is that Venezuela thought that it was the opportunity to hit the United States in terms of the U.S.-Russian discussion on the NORCA policy of the United States in order to implement the basilistic system, the new basilistic system, in front of Russia. And he thought that it will be an opportunity not only to show the support of Venezuela in Russia policy, but also to show the United States that Venezuela will be able to play in the international arena. But don't forget that Chavez has some kind of dream that Venezuela could be a big power and a big player in the international arena. That's why he took advantages, according to him, of the vacuum that were in the Georgia affair in that specific time. There is no more than that. It was, in my opinion, opportunist in order to take advantages of the quarrels between the Russia and the United States in relation with the Georgia in relation about the Georgia affair.
But he didn't recognize Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Why didn't he go that far?
Yeah, well, because in my opinion, he thought that it was not good to continue to this kind of relationship.
Yes, my name is Petrovsky, and I have an NGO in Venezuela called Petropolitan that fights for oil revenue sharing. This debate is framed as Venezuela and Russia, what sort of relationship? And I would like to ask the panel, what percentage of this is a relationship between Venezuela and Russia, and how much is it a result of a relationship between Chavez and Putin, two brothers in arms in sort of being petro-autocrats, both of them? Because in my mind, Venezuela and Russia, that's 1%, and the rest is a relation just between two petro-autocrats, a totally different world. I think that you used the song. Another version of that could be that Chavez will find it very hard to buy hate. He won't be able to can't buy me hate in the American public for the U.S. It is a very special, personal, very small agenda, driven and financed by oil. Thank you.
Well, I think that you might be right, but that misses the point that these are the people who are heads of the state. If Chavez were replaced tomorrow in Venezuela by a different constellation of political forces, my sense, and I'm not an expert on Venezuela, my sense is that the foreign policies of that government would be substantially different. If Putin were replaced tomorrow, it would not be the same. But there would be some change in foreign policy, but I agree with Andy. I think the Russian foreign policy is intrinsically anti-American and driven by this obsession with great power status because of the nature of the Russian political system, regardless of who the man is at the top. The fact of the matter is that we have two rather unique individuals who are in full control of their state and driving the policy that way. So you may be right, but the fact of the matter is that today, and both of these men, I think, are autocrats in their own way. You know, l'état c'est moi. They are the state. And that's true in Russian. That's true in the Venezuelan case. Now, with regard to Putin, yeah, I fully agree with Andrew's concept. I remember 9 years ago when Putin was first president, and he came out with this campaign autobiography of Vladimir Putin in the first person, Petr from Lietso. I read this. This is I guess it's a sanitized version. It's what he wants people to think about himself. I grew up in South Brooklyn, and I knew kids like that. These guys never forget anything. They want to get even with everybody. If they have political skill, they end up like Putin in charge of a crime boss, as well as maybe a political boss. Otherwise, they end up doing a hard time somewhere. It's very clear to me that the foreign policies here are driven by systemic imperatives, in Russia's case, as well as by personal imperatives of the Tsar, because the system is an autocratic system. So it gives the man at the top full freedom to do as he pleases to anybody he likes, as you said about Putin, that it's a system based on the old Leninist principle of who does what to whom. And if you're the Tsar, being the Tsar means, to quote an old movie, never having to say you're sorry. And Putin is that man. In Venezuela, Chavez, in a very different kind of system, which is more sort of populist and elements of charisma and military, has that kind of power too. But it's not a system that's going to survive him in any meaningful sense. I think when he goes, the system he created goes with it. Putin's system could survive without Putin, although some of the heat would go out of it and some of the intensity. But the fundamental autocratic, anti-democratic nature of the Russian political culture, this obsession with great power status, that transcends Putin. But he's taking it to its limits today in an anti-American direction. So as long as these men are in charge, they are the state.
Thanks, Andy. Carlos, anybody?
I think that both guys, to some extent, are comrades in arms in that they have sort of default positions that are anti-American for different reasons. But I think we know what they are. I won't speak for Mr. Chavez. I'll leave that to Carlos. Mr. Putin, again, my thinking about him has been changing recently because I see a certain evolution that I find very, very worrisome. I think in the first 8 years when he was president, you can kind of chart a pretty strong correlation between Putin's behavior and the oil price. And when he first came to power, while obviously he was never a Democrat and had no instincts in that direction, he was inclined to be – he was much more progressive on economic reform and carried out, I think, a number of reforms that I think many of us were surprised at how aggressive he was. That changed as soon as the oil price began to rise dramatically in 2003, 2004. And the seminal event there was the Yukos affair, which sort of changed the trajectory of his leadership. But that was all facilitated by windfall revenues coming in from oil and gas exports, which allowed them to turn away from the economic reform agenda and do what he wanted to do politically. And he very instrumentally used certain events to do so, including the terrorist act at Beslan. If I were Mr. Chavez, I would certainly not trust Mr. Putin at all, and understand that principally he's dealing with a very, very cold-blooded guy who instrumentally uses people and things to advance his purposes. And when that person is no longer useful for that purpose, they will be discarded. Sort of mindful of a Stalinist approach to you squeeze a person like a lemon, and then when there's no more juice, you throw it away. So I hope he doesn't have any illusions about this. My concern, again, about Mr. Putin is that increasingly, I could find explanations for his behavior in Russian policy that had, certain rational explanations and even economic justifications for it. Increasingly, I see less of that. And I see that these decisions are being made more on the basis of political whims, psychological whims, revenge, etc.
Yes, I would like to add to the following.
Don't forget that Hugo Chavez is a third world leader. And the Soviets and the Russians, of course, has a lot of experience with the third world leaders. I remember in the late 70s and the early 80s, when the people related with the Soviet Union foreign policy process, especially in the academia, began to criticize the Soviet role in the third world. And one of the most striking things was to rethink the relationship between the Soviet Union and some political parties and some leaders and also with some governments of the third world, including, of course, Fidel Castro. And the outcomes of those thinking and debates inside the Soviet academia was that the Soviet Union has to move from the third world to the second and of course, the one world. And it was the beginning of the criticism of the new thinking. I mean, about the criticism of the necessity to move from the Russian, Soviet classic support of revolution in the world to has a strong foreign policy based on the state-state relations. Of course, Putin used Chavez, but Chavez also used Putin. And I think, as you say, that in many cases, the Russians knows how to deal with this kind of new third world leader, Chavez, and also has the limitations to go on with him, because in any of the most critical situations, recently speaking, Chavez has tried to go beyond the Russians, and the Russians know how to stop him.
Thanks, Carlos. Question over here. John, you get the microphone.
My name is John Maestro. I'm a retired U.S. ambassador. And I was intrigued by Dr. Blank's reference to a Russian linkage with drug exports from Venezuela. Is that a state-to-state thing? Is that a private sector thing? Are the Europeans aware of it, since, you know, the bulk of those drugs go to Europe for consumption? And I was wondering if anybody had any comments on that linkage and implications. And secondly, congratulations. The presentations were just excellent, Peter.
Thanks,
Jim.
Steve.
Yeah, let me give you some of the evidence. I did a paper earlier this year for CSIS and the French Institute of International Relations on Russian Latin American foreign policy. So Moscow clearly knows that Chavez has allowed Venezuela to become a major transshipment point for narcotics trafficking, not only to Europe, to the United States and Africa as well. That's not a secret to anybody, and I assume the SVR is a highly competent intelligence organization and knows about this. But in 2003, we had reports that Mexico's narcotics gangs were being penetrated by Russian criminals. Earlier this year, a Russian and Cuban were arrested for drug smuggling in Yucatan. There is a lot of evidence from Southcom and the DEA about Venezuela being a drug haven. In 2000, as a matter of fact, Colombian drug runners were arrested with an entire Soviet Russian submarine, a kilo-class submarine that had been smuggled out of Russia and brought to the mountains of Colombia. It's an amazing story. They got caught. Now they were going to use the submarine to smuggle drugs into the U.S. So I'm fully aware that Moscow is aware of this. Now, I don't think this is a bunch of rogue intelligence operators or rogue criminals in the government doing that. I think that Moscow knows what's going on and it looks the other way. Now, the irony is that if you read the Russian press, the head of the Russian Federal Service for Control over Narcotics Trafficking, Viktor Ivanov, is screaming bloody murder about the threat to Russia from drug addiction, mainly from Afghanistan, which is extremely serious. But this is really a national security threat to Russia, because Ivanov estimated that 30,000 people a year die. I don't even know how many are addicts. And it gets mixed up with people having HIV and injecting themselves with bad needles and so on. So, and in Russia's demographic situation, losing 30,000 people a year, particularly in the most fertile age group, 18 to 39, is a catastrophe. So the irony is, I'm sure that Moscow knows this is going on, and the arms sales are going to abet this kind of thing, because submarines make no sense for Chavez other than to move drugs beyond Venezuela's land boundary. So they are, on the one hand, either complicit with him or involved in actual drug running from Latin America to other places. And on the other hand, they are a victim of this, with suffering grievously as a result of the importation of drugs into Russia, mainly from Afghanistan, but perhaps from Europe as well. It's typical of Russian foreign policy. Just the pursuit of advantage. You know, we're going to destabilize the United States at all costs, even if we have to suffer as a result. It goes back to what Andy has said about this kind of spiteful policy. And it's characteristic of Russia today.
I could just add one thing to what Steve was saying. I think at a kind of a macro level, I think the big difference between Russia in the last 9 years versus Russia in the 1990s is that what was attributed to so-called organized crime in the 1990s on lots of issues, be it drug trafficking, arms sales, illicit arms sales, human trafficking, et cetera. I mean, a lot of those activities have been, in effect, sort of privatized by the state. You to be able to parse that's a general trend that I think we've seen in Putin's Russia, that the state has been able to centralize control broadly over a lot of activities that it might have been easier for the Russians to claim plausible deniability for in the 1990s. It's a little more difficult now.
One point I want to add here. I mean, if you talk to European intelligence and officials and diplomats off the record, they will tell you, and this is their term, that Russia is a mafia state. That's their term, not mine. But it's absolutely correct. And this is a perfect example of it.
We have time for one more. No more
Peter.
Questions. We
have
Peter.
To, I'm sorry. Carlos, please. Just a comment. It seems to me that we have to be aware that we are able to reproduce Cold War mentality. We try to add to the Russian state presence in Latin America something related with the Russian mafia, the crime, and so on. Remember that in the past, some things that happened in Latin America related with the Soviet Union was blamed by to say that the Soviet Union support the communist parties and the guerrillas and warfare and so on. Now, we will able to do that, and I think that we have to prevent that anything that happened with Russians outside the state-state relation is supported by the state, the Russian state. So please, I will say that we have to look at that and to prevent it.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, please thank our distinguished panelists for their presentation. And thank you all very much for having come.